Station, Lac Vaud d'Or, Natanz or Isfahan, the agency issues detailed reports on them every 3 months. These facilities are inspected, transparent, internationally recognized, and engage in peaceful activity. So when such sites are attacked, that attack is an illegal act under international law because it targets facilities under IAEA oversight that are in full compliance with the NPT. Yet they attempt to justify this unlawful behavior through the very resolutions issued against Iran. Even before the Zionist regime's attack on Iran, a resolution had already been passed, and these resolutions are then used as political cover. In other words, they are manufacturing legitimacy. Under international law, as long as a site is under IAEA supervision and complying with the NPT, no state has the right to attack it. But through these resolutions, they try to turn the situation into a political asset, using it to increase pressure on Iran, push for further isolation, discourage other countries from engaging with Iran, and build negative media narratives. They create a wide range of storylines around these issues. Yet, when you look closely, there is not a single piece of evidence, according to the agency itself, that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons.
On safeguards, the Europeans argued Iran has delayed verification of enriched materials and failed to implement several NPT obligations. They also insisted that Tehran submit a special report on the damaged facilities, grant access to key sites, and resolve what they call unresolved issues. Unable to meet their own JCPOA commitments, the Europeans now accuse Iran of failing to restore trust and transparency, particularly regarding enriched uranium stockpiles. Dr. Kanani Moqaddam stated that the West's hidden agenda is to overthrow the Islamic Republic.
What do you think is the real reason and motivation behind the European Troika's action? And basically, do you think there exists a hidden agenda contrary to what they state and express?
The overarching plan the West is pursuing regarding Iran is essentially a Libya-style model. The idea is to first dismantle Iran's nuclear capabilities and remove its equipment, then intensify pressure on Iran's missile program and regional policies. After that, NATO and the UK would be in a position to carry out military action with ease. And as we saw in Libya, the result of such a model is a country that becomes fragmented, loses its sovereign authority, faces a power vacuum, and is stripped of its capabilities, gaining nothing in return.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. First, Iran condemns draft resolution by US E3 at IAEBOG. Iran's permanent representative to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Reza Najafi, censured a draft resolution proposed by the United States and three European countries at the IAEA Board of Governors, calling it a bid to impose unjustified and illegal reporting obligations on the United Nations Atomic Agency's Director General Rafael Grossi. The anti-Iranian resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors will not change Iran's status of safeguards implementation, Najafi said ahead of the upcoming BOG meeting, which took place from November 19 to 21 in Vienna. He argued that Washington and the E3 are once again trying to manipulate international mechanisms in order to impose their unreasonable and coercive positions on the Iranian nation. Forcing Grossi to base reports on expired UN Security Council resolutions is not only completely unlawful and unjustified, but will also, in practice, increase existing complexities and deal another setback to diplomacy, the Iranian diplomat added. Iran words of countermeasures against illegal IAEA resolution. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said Tehran is considering more countermeasures against an illegal resolution adopted by the International Atomic Energy Agency regarding the country's peaceful nuclear program. Ismail Baghaei made the remarks on November 21, one day after the IAEA's 35-member Board of Governors passed the anti-Iran resolution put forward by France, the UK, Germany, and the United States. In response, Tehran announced the termination of the deal it signed in Egypt's Cairo in September to resume cooperation with the UN's nuclear watchdog. The ties had been suspended after the deadly U.S.-Israel aggression against Iran in June. Baghaei said in an official letter to the agency, "We declared that the so-called Cairo agreement, which had been reached with Iran's goodwill and after relatively long negotiations with the agency, is now canceled. Other measures are also under consideration." Tehran Times. MPs ponder response to IAEA's anti-Iran resolution. The National Security and Foreign Policy Committee of the Iranian Parliament categorically condemned the recently adopted anti-Iran resolution by the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency after beginning the process to devise an appropriate response. Ebrahim Rezaei, the spokesperson for the committee, dismissed the resolution as politically motivated and illegal, highlighting the need to show a strong and deterrent reaction to the move. He made the comments following an extraordinary session of the committee attended by Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister and the Deputy Head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. Rezaei had previously suggested that Tehran leave the NPT. This session was held in order to review the IAEA's recent resolution against the Islamic Republic of Iran, he explained. IRNA. Russia anti-Iran resolution by IAEA BOG is a serious blow to credibility of agency. Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova said that Russia considers the anti-Iranian and provocative resolution of the International Atomic Energy Agency proposed by the Western camp a serious blow to international confidence in the IAEA safeguards and the nuclear NPT. Reacting to the vote of the IAEA Board of Governors on the draft resolution on the NPT safeguards agreement with the Islamic Republic of Iran, Zakharova said that there is no need for emergency action by the IAEA Board of Governors regarding the verification activities in Iran. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson pointed out that the IAEA secretariat had not requested any instructions from the IAEA Board of Governors. She said that Russia recognizes Iran's continued adherence to its obligations under the NPT and the Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, despite the U.S. and Israeli attacks on its nuclear facilities under IAEA safeguards in June. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative. For many years, Iran's peaceful nuclear program has been the target of political pressure and Western allegations. Before the JCPOA, the possible military dimensions file became the centerpiece of sanctions and threats. But when that file was formally closed in 2015, the pretext disappeared, albeit for a while. After the JCPOA was signed, Iran complied. The United States did not, walking away in 2018. Europe, meanwhile, never delivered the economic benefits it had promised. In response, Iran exercised its JCPOA-defined rights and scaled back commitments. 7 years of diplomacy followed. Iran says it approached negotiations in good faith. Western governments, however, responded with delays and ever-increasing demands.
When the Zionist regime carried out its illegal attack against Iran and its nuclear facilities, European countries not only refused to condemn it, they even expressed satisfaction. They particularly welcomed any adverse event that might occur in Iran, whether targeting nuclear sites or even affecting Iranian civilians. This clearly shows that the concerns the West claims to have about Iran are not technical at all. They are entirely political. There are numerous precedents for this. Consider the nuclear agreement. When the United States withdrew from the JCPOA, Europe, despite its explicit commitments under the deal, did not activate the snapback mechanism against the US, nor did it uphold its promised cooperation with Iran. In one of the joint meetings about a year after the US withdrawal in 2019, The Europeans made a series of commitments during the session with the JCPOA Joint Commission, yet they failed to fulfill any of them. They even pretended to introduce certain initiatives to preserve the agreement and deliver the economic benefits Iran was supposed to receive, but none of these materialized. In practice, Europe's conduct after the JCPOA and following the US withdrawal demonstrated that they were playing a complementary role to the United States. Europeans maintained a diplomatic facade of commitment, but in reality they sought to ensure that only Iran remained bound to the agreement, while Iran received none of the benefits it was promised.
On November 20th, Iran's foreign ministry condemned the new resolution as illegal and unjustifiable, imposed under pressure from Washington, London, Paris, and Berlin. Hours later, Iran's foreign minister announced that the Cairo agreement between Iran and the IAEA can no longer be implemented. Tehran notes that 5 months earlier, a biased IAEA report helped clear the way for the June attacks carried out by Israel and the United States. Even then, Iran continued cooperating. Back in September, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi made a new inspection agreement in Cairo, only for the European Troika and the U.S. to revive snapback once again. Supported by Russia and China, Iran rejected the process as legally invalid. From Iran's perspective, the West's decision to activate the snapback killed the Cairo agreement outright. Now, Tehran says that the U.S. must answer one basic question. If U.S. President Donald Trump claims that he destroyed Iran's nuclear facilities, then what exactly does the West want to inspect? The new resolution seeks to revive demands from long-expired U.N. resolutions requiring Iran to suspend enrichment. According to Iran, the board has no legal authority to resurrect terminated Security Council measures. The Troika's attempt to imply such authority exposes bad faith and disregard for IAEA procedures. To Tehran, the text reads like a manifesto of threats aimed at restricting Iran's strategic capabilities, a project championed for decades by the U.S., Europe, and Israel.
Iran has several possible courses of action. The first is a snapback against snapback approach, meaning we raise the cost of such measures to a level that Europeans reconsider exerting pressure on the Islamic Republic. Part of this relates to energy, and part of it concerns international waterways such as Bab al-Mandeb, the Persian Gulf, and the Indian Ocean. Iran has the ability to raise Europe's energy costs to a point where some governments already facing economic crises may regret entering a game designed for them by the Americans. In parts of Europe, there are still rational actors who do not wish to follow U.S. policy line by line. The second path is through diplomacy. We must continue dialogue and emphasize our right to the peaceful use of nuclear energy, a right recognized under international law and accepted by all. We're still within the framework of the NPT. We have not withdrawn, and we should maintain this course to reach a balance between pressures and resistance. The third option is reaching a point of no return, moving the nuclear program to the edge of breakout, enriching up to 90%, conducting a nuclear test, withdrawing from the NPT, and disrupting the regional order the United States seeks to impose. But entering such a path could lead to a conflict whose scope is unknown, including whether it could escalate into a global war.
Yet, Iran emphasizes a key point. Not one IAEA inspection report has ever accused Iran of blocking inspectors. Not one. Before the attacks, Iran had the highest inspection rate in the world. Nearly three-quarters of IAEA verification activities in all safeguard agreement states occurred in Iran. In 2024, the IAEA conducted 1,381 inspector days there. Among 32 countries operating without the additional protocol, Iran, with only 3% of global enrichment capacity, accounted for more than 70% of all inspections. But while Iran's transparency has been unmatched, Israel, armed with an undeclared nuclear arsenal estimated up to 400 warheads and never a member of the NPT, operates outside any inspections. UN Resolution 487 demanded that Israel place its facilities under safeguards. It never has. The result, from Iran's perspective, the IAEA is no longer acting as a neutral arbiter. What was meant to be an impartial watchdog now appears to function as a vehicle for Western political pressure.
In short, Israel has not accepted the NPT, whereas Iran has. Israel is a member of the IAEA, but it has never signed the agency's most fundamental treaty, and because it has not signed it, it does not consider itself bound by it. So why is there no pressure on Israel? Because it's an ally of the United States, Germany, the UK, France, and other dominant powers. In today's world, international law is not what truly governs. Power does. It is power that shapes international relations. That's why Israel, backed by the US, the UK, France, Germany, and others, can simply refuse to join the NPT, remain a member of the IAEA, and at the same time possess more than 300 nuclear warheads. Why cannot Iran do the same? First, because they would never accept it. Iran has fundamentally challenged international order and the existing balance of power. Iran views this system as hegemonic and domineering and is in confrontation with it on various fronts, including the nuclear issue. So it's clear that they will seize on any pretext, including the nuclear file, to prevent Iran from operating outside the NPT framework, even if those activities are purely peaceful. For them, this is a convenient instrument to maintain pressure on a country that has dared to challenge the existing international system.
After 22 years of allegations and political maneuvering, the IAEA Board of Governors' latest resolution confirms that the agency is no longer an independent supervisor. It is an operational arm of Western policy, applying pressure, issuing threats, and advancing a strategy of containment. Tehran views the resolution as the final, unmistakable sign of a system no longer aligned with fairness, impartiality, or the principles of the non-proliferation regime. We asked Dr. Aberi to outline the possible scenarios that lie ahead.
What do you think would be Iran's next move?
It seems the United States and Europe are once again trying to pull Iran back to the negotiating table, but for an unfair agreement, one based on their imposed conditions. One of the key conditions they insisted on in the past and continue to insist on today, despite its illegality, is stripping Iran of its right to uranium enrichment. This, in fact, is the most optimistic scenario. I personally believe there is also a more pessimistic scenario, that the West is not actually seeking oversight of Iran's nuclear program. Rather, they want additional intelligence about the facilities that were attacked and about enriched materials buried beneath them, so they can complete the sabotage of operations previously carried out against Iran's nuclear program. Even in the optimistic scenario, their aim is to shut down Iran's nuclear program and reduce it to whatever level they consider acceptable. There is also a third scenario, neither a new agreement nor a military strike, but instead an escalation of maximum pressure on Iran. To intensify this pressure, they seek a legal mechanism. The Board of Governors resolution is essentially an attempt to give legal cover to the unjust pressure they want to impose. Iran is familiar with all these scenarios and has prepared itself accordingly. Over the past two decades, and even after the Zionist regime's recent attack, Iran's primary effort has consistently been to follow a legal and legitimate path, cooperate with international institutions, and rebuild international confidence in its nuclear program, not merely the confidence of Western governments. In my view, the most likely scenario is that Iran will once again pursue a legal process to disrupt and counter this Western strategy against it.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Until next time, take care.
diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran. We are glad you could join us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. After that, we have A to Z of Life. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of ayahs of the Holy Quran, as well as inspirational poetry and stories. And our final program this hour is again our radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
If we were able to target cancer cells directly without affecting the healthy tissue surrounding it? Well, that's exactly what the scientists here at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran have been able to do using yttrium-90. So in this week's episode of Iran Tech with me, your host Ali Reza, we're going to dive deep into how yttrium-90 can be used to target cancer cells in the liver directly without affecting the healthy tissue surrounding it. Stay tuned. Let's clarify something first. When I say liver cancer, I don't mean just the type of cancer that the cancer tumors that originate from within the liver. I also mean other types of cancers that have metastasized, and you can find the metastasized cancer tumors inside the liver as well, which actually makes up the majority of liver cancer cases. And treating liver cancer has been traditionally difficult using surgery and chemotherapy because only about 30% of actual patients qualify to get these treatments. And, you know, speaking of the treatments, chemotherapy itself is unpleasant, and we all know it. You lose body hair, your body is weak. There's plenty of reasons to try to avoid it if you can. And you can using this groundbreaking technology. Microspheres that contain yttrium-90, these tiny glass beads with this radioactive isotope, the radioisotope of yttrium, not the neutral yttrium-89, the radioactive one, yttrium-90. So you can inject these tiny glass beads into the bloodstream, into the blood supply of the cancer tumors, and it can selectively, using selective internal radiation therapy, SIRT, it can target those cancer cells directly and, you know, leave everything else untouched. So this is how yttrium-90 can help treat liver cancer. So first, we're going to learn about how it's made, and then we're going to take a closer look at how it works.
Our particle manufacturing process as microspray involves several stages. To create the particle, we first combine the raw materials and form a suspension. We then synthesize them using the Sol-Gel method to achieve the desired chemical composition. After completing the Sol-Gel process, the next step is drying to obtain the target powder. Subsequently, to achieve the intended structural properties, biocompatibility, and a specific characteristic termed patyl, the synthesized powder undergoes heat treatment at a controlled temperature. Following this, the sample is milled, and the insert process, a term used for spheroidization, is performed to shape the particles into spheres. Once spheroidization is complete, the particles are spherical, but exhibit a broad size distribution, ranging from approximately 15 to 20 micrometers. However, the final product requires particles between 10 to 20 micrometers. To achieve this, we perform particle size classification using mechanical sieving, mechanical screening. After sieving, quality control, QC, is conducted under a microscope. The particles are then sterilized, packaged into specialized vials, and sent for irradiation.
These microspheres, these tiny glass beads that contain yttrium-90, they need to be a very specific size, between 20 to 40, 50 microns, so basically thinner than a hair strand. And they need to be exactly that size or exactly within that range, because if they are too small, then they could essentially seep into other organs of the body. If they are too big, they will just get lodged into the main vessel that is going into the liver. So it needs to be, the size needs to be just right. So once they are injected, they'll essentially lodge themselves around the area where the cancer tumor is getting fed from the blood supply. And they start emitting beta rays that start to shrink the cancer tumor by destroying the DNA of the cancer tumor. And that way, it'll gradually shrink down and get replaced by healthy cells to the point that we can hopefully say that the cancer tumor is essentially gone. And it's compared to the typical external radiation methods, you know, you have to do multiple hospital visits, whereas this is a one-time injection, which is also a lot more precise, hence the selective internal radiation therapy, SIRT. So we're going to take a closer look at how this process works first, and then talk about the broader implications of it.
The patient is first prepared with mild sedation and local anesthesia at the groin. A small incision is made to allow insertion of a catheter into the femoral artery. Using real-time imaging, the catheter is carefully navigated through the arterial network until it reaches the hepatic artery, the main vessel supplying the liver. At this point, a carefully measured suspension of yttrium-90 loaded glass microspheres is injected directly into the hepatic artery. These microspheres, each between 20 and 50 microns in diameter, travel with the bloodstream until they lodge in the tiny arterioles feeding the tumor. Their small size ensures that they preferentially accumulate in the tumor's vascular bed while bypassing much of the healthy tissue. Once the microspheres are in place, they begin to emit beta radiation. This form of radiation penetrates only a few millimeters, targeting the tumor cells while largely sparing the surrounding healthy liver tissue. The beta particles disrupt the DNA within cancer cells, impairing their ability to divide and triggering cell death. This localized radiation gradually shrinks the tumor over several days, as the continuous emission of energy damages the cancer cell's structural integrity. The entire injection process typically takes between 60 to 90 minutes. In the days following the treatment, the microspheres continue to emit radiation, steadily damaging the tumor from within. Throughout this process, the targeted nature of the therapy minimizes systemic side effects typically seen with the traditional chemotherapy or external radiation. By concentrating the therapeutic effects directly at the tumor site, normal liver function is largely preserved, and patients often experience a significant improvement in their quality of life. The precision of this treatment reduces complications and supports a quicker recovery, allowing patients to resume their normal activities sooner. This method represents a significant advance in the treatment of liver cancer, offering a minimally invasive alternative that delivers high doses of radiation directly to the tumor while minimizing exposure to healthy tissues.
In
It is important to note that the yttrium or Newell glass microspheres injected into patients are biocompatible. The particle size for these microspheres is within the 40 to 50 micron range. Particles smaller than 50 microns risk passing through hepatic capillaries and leaking into the lungs. Particles larger than 50 microns avoid this issue, as they do not migrate from blood vessels into the liver mass. Due to these critical size-dependent effects, strict quality control, QC testing, is performed on the particles to ensure their size falls within the specified range.
The yttrium glass microspheres discussed here are not our primary focus. However, they represent the latest achievement of the radiotherapy equipment research laboratories at the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute and are classified as medical devices. This technology serves as a non-surgical alternative for inoperable tumors, either as a standalone treatment or in combination with chemotherapy. A key advantage of this method over conventional radiotherapy is its ability to spare healthy liver tissues, which are highly sensitive to radiation, thereby minimizing adverse side effects. We selected a product with a 100-day time frame to enable faster commercialization and market readiness. Currently, our laboratory focuses on producing internal radiotherapy products, including brachytherapy techniques. These are targeted therapeutic methods capable of localized treatment of tumor tissues. Producing these devices positions us as a regional hub for advancing medical tourism. It is worth noting that our laboratory is the only active facility in the country and the broader region, excluding Russia, specializing in the production of medical radioactive sources. This grants us significant potential in medical tourism. The production of yttrium-90 glass microspheres has already been successfully implemented at the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute. The pilot scale production stages are now complete. The animal phase has been completed, and all necessary tests, including toxicity, dimensional, and density tests, which are specific to the production process, have been conducted. The physical parameters of the product align with those of commercial sources, and from our perspective, this phase is fully accomplished. However, to enter the market, it was imperative to conduct the clinical phase to determine the product's efficacy. We are currently carrying out the clinical phase in collaboration with Shahid Beheshti, University of Medical Sciences. Approximately 20 patients have been treated with this product so far. Initial results reported by the treating physicians have been satisfactory, meeting the parameters we prioritize, such as absence of toxicity, no leakage to other organs, and concentration in liver tissue. These outcomes have been observed and documented in several early-stage treatment cases. Indeed, the preliminary results have been declared promising. These results may include reductions in tumor size, tumor necrosis, decreased vascularization, diminished blood supply to the tumor tissue, and I would like to highlight reduced metabolic activity within the tumor area. Fortunately, the outcomes thus far have been encouraging. God willing, upon completing the clinical phase and analyzing the results, we will proceed to secure the required permits from the Ministry of Health, Treatment, and Medical Education to introduce this product to the market and commence its commercial distribution.
Today we showed you how our scientists are working hard to cause a breakthrough and sort of a revolution in liver cancer treatment in Iran using these microspheres that contain yttrium-90, the radioisotope of yttrium, which, fun fact, is actually being produced inside this nuclear power reactor because you need a reactor to create radioisotopes. And we're waiting for the final stages of the clinical trials to get the approval to be able to produce it at scale, to become only the second country in the world to be able to produce these yttrium-90 radioisotopes at scale for commercial use. So we're hoping for that to happen sooner rather than later. And with that said, we've come to the end of this episode of Iran Sec.
Let's see. This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, don't go to any trouble. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on RIB English Radio with my sister Zainab. And look, the attitude of, you know, don't go to any trouble. It's it's one that many people do have, and we don't want to bother other people too much. We don't want to put other people out. We don't want them to go to any trouble. And look, I'm going to mention both an anecdote from life of one of the famous martyrs from the Holy Defense, and also at least one more personal anecdote, just to sort of give you an idea of, you know, what this is and to what length some of us go to sort of avoid putting people out. So I'll just mention something from the life of the martyr Seyyidjan Bozorghi, who was actually martyred after the Holy Defense due to quite horrible war injuries. After his wedding, he was invited to the houses of various relatives. But what he did, because he didn't want to sort of put other people out, so he sort of organized it in such a way so that they didn't even have to prepare lunch or dinner for him or for him and his wife, so that all the visits that he made were just turned into visits to just have a quick cup of tea. And, you know, and this is something that, maybe some of us have also been in that situation where, you know, we don't want to sort of, we're careful in terms of what time we visit people, because we don't want people to start preparing lunch or dinner for us. So we sort of organize things at a time where we know, yeah, that's okay. They're only going to feel the need to sort of just offer us a cup of tea. Welcome back to A to Z here on RIB English Radio with me, sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about this idea that, you know, we often don't want to, we don't want to put people out. We don't want to bother them too much. So we're often a little bit careful, you know, when we visit people or when we even organize to meet people, I think, as to not putting them out. And even just now, just be quite honest, sometimes it even... for example, even in my situation, it can even come down to not wanting to organize meetups with friends even, or indeed with sort of a family of friends, when it could sort of turn into a lunch or dinner. Because imagine you want to catch up with someone outside, maybe you want to just meet them for a coffee or so, but again, we have to sort of consider, okay, when we meet them for a coffee or tea, you know, because often even that can sometimes be tricky, because then we think, because we will want to try and invite them. And then it comes with many of us, not whatever country we're in, you know, as Islamic brothers and sisters, often there's this sort of discussion, well, who's going to pay? And then it's sometimes very difficult to not get the other person to pay. And maybe some of you have even involved various sort of secretive little ploys to try and not get them to pay, you know, try to quickly pay before they even have the chance to pay. And then also when we meet with people, it could even be that, you know, if we're meeting for coffee or tea, A, there's the issue of maybe we want to pay, so we have to deal with that so they don't pay. But then if it's at the wrong time of day, then there's even the issue they will try to pay for lunch or dinner for us. And that is even worse. So, you know, I think this is just the way we are as Muslims, that we don't want to people out. We don't want, and for sure we don't want them to sort of, pay for us. For us, usually, if it's easier for us to pay for others and to invite others than to be invited. But, you know, there is also the issue. I know for sure that as we all love to invite people, so maybe sometimes we actually need to let the other person pay because they actually get joy out of paying for us or inviting us or hosting us. So that is a consideration. So maybe we should sort of take that into account and not be always reluctant and actually accept the blessing that other people want to provide for us. So that's a totally different point. So I pray that that's just a reminder for us, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Iron Beings Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran. Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
It is He who has sent His apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that He may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough. Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
Balochistan is populated by over 9,000 villages. The village of Ghalanor dates back to the Qajar period, and since this area isn't prone to earthquakes, the adobe houses have managed to survive for about 150 years. Isn't that amazing?
About 40 kilometers from the city of Zobol, this village was originally built on top of a hill and witnessed the migration of the villages of Old Fort. In fact, that's where it gets its name, Ghalanor, which means new fort. Kalenur was built on high ground to protect its occupants from flood, since the varying amount of the flowing water of the Hamul River has always caused different problems for the people living in the Sistan Basin. But that's not the only thing the architects of this village had up their sleeves. During the Qajar period in the 18th and 19th centuries, different regions were managed by overlords or khans. The most eye-catching structure here is the two-story adobe castle of the Khan of the region. It was built at the entrance of the village and around a small hill, so the top of the hill is the floor of the second story. The village is currently being restored and is going to be turned into an ecotourism village. Kilometers from Kalenur lies a mysterious and ancient city referred to over the past 200 to 300 years as Dahonir Ghulaman, or Gateway of the Slaves. Dahonir Ghulaman is the largest Achaemenian site in the entire eastern section of Iran that has been dated back to between the 4th and the 6th century BC. More importantly, it's the only Achaemenid site that may hold within its depths the secrets of the lifestyle of the ordinary people living at that time. Built in the wilderness, away from the imperial capital, even with the alignment of buildings roughly in a straight line, running southwest to northeast along the edge of water supplies, the site was only inhabited for a brief period of a century or a century and a half, and was abandoned as a result of natural forces that have always determined the survival and migration of urban settlements in the arid region of Sistan. The entire site was covered by sand. After it was dug up about 50 years ago in the 1960s, the layout of this ancient city was studied extensively by archaeologists from around the world. And it seems that they all came to a similar conclusion. The precise architecture and great harmony in the design of Dahonir Ghulaman suggests that it was built with urban planning in mind about 2,500 years ago. Geometric studies on this site have revealed 27 major structures and an additional 23 buildings, most of which have not yet been unearthed. It was believed that the Achaemenids used architectural plans only in the construction of palaces and important buildings, such as the royal residences of Pasargad, Persepolis, Susa, as well as Dasht-e Gohar. But it seems that the people of Dahonir Ghulaman even prepared an architectural plan for the construction of their alleys and ordinary houses. The urban planning, the architecture, the temple, the location and size of what remains of this ancient city have led scholars to believe that it was a satrapal capital or something very similar to it in character. Studies into the origins of the hearths, fireplaces and altars have tried to reveal their purpose since they have a unique architecture. Were they used for animal sacrifices since animal blood was found on the altars? What kind of rituals were performed here? All these studies have tried to find answers to the many questions that arose 40 years ago with the unearthing of the site and have never been completely answered, even to this day. Standing atop the nearby hill that gives you an overview of the site, you can see lakes filled with a considerable amount of water around it. The Chaimime reservoirs in the south of Zabul are three big lakes that are the second most important water storage reservoirs in the region. The water stored in these big lakes is used to irrigate the Sistan Plain and to provide drinking water for the cities of Zabul and Zahedan. Trees were planted all around the lakes by the University of Zabul to prevent dust from falling into the water. This is Golnar Farnoudi for Iran.
this beautiful old wooden door lies an ancient civilization, a wealth of cultural, artistic, and religious jewels that portray the civilization of a nation.
The Qom Astana Museum, located in the city of Qom, right near the holy shrine of Fatima Masuma, sister of Imam Riza, opened up its doors to the public back in 1935. The museum has an area of 1,000 square meters with two floors hosting two exhibition halls. More than 1,000 artifacts and objects of artistic, cultural, and historical value are displayed here. These treasures belong to different periods in history, from the 1st and 2nd millennium BC to the Islamic era in the country. The museum displays a wide range of objects and artifacts, varying from paintings, chinaware, ceramics and pottery, to priceless handmade rugs, glassware and precious Qurans.
Museum near to the shrine of Fatima Masura. It's wonderful to look around this museum, particularly to look at the carpet, beautiful carpet, and with the silk beautifully designed. And also I look around some other places to look at the Quran, the oldest Quran from the 9th century to the present time. It's amazing to keep those kind of like traditional symbolic teachings of Prophet Muhammad.
The crown jewel of Iran's handicraft industry is its beautiful handmade rugs and carpets. Excavations in Iran have revealed that this art dates back to the 1st and 2nd millennium BC. The treasured silk rugs in this museum are valuable for their extraordinary designs, rich combination of colors, and excellent texture. One of the main features of Islamic architecture is the gorgeous glazed tiles that decorate the interior and exterior of the buildings. This art form reached new heights during the 14th century when the Timurid Empire ruled the country. The oldest tiles in this museum belong to the Seljuk era, some 12 centuries ago.
Beautiful doors opened up to. There must have been a beautiful heaven behind these doors that inspired the artist to create wonders on these beautiful creations.
The decorated doors displayed here date back to different time periods, but all adorned beautifully with different artistic techniques. Some are decorated with the art of marquetry, wood inlaying and wood carving with delicate pieces of ivory, bone, brass, gold and silver sections. Others are made with metal, embellished with inscriptions written by the best calligraphers of the time.
Size isn't really an issue when it comes to narrating history. Some items here in this museum are quite small in size, but great and precise narrators that reveal historical facts.
Museums are the spiritual and cultural treasures of a nation that clearly display the wisdom